And we are live. This is Value After Hours. I am Tobias Carlisle, joined as always by my co-host, Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is John Rotonti Jr. What's up, John? How are you?
Hi, Tobias. Hi, Jake. Thanks for having me on the show again. I'm
Welcome
doing really
back.
well. Yeah, thank you. Doing well.
I see that I'm no longer esteemed co-host. I've been demoted to just regular co-host.
You esteemed? I felt a bit bad. I thought maybe that was like a...
That's too much.
Nick Diz or something.
You've been demoted. Now you're just, yeah, now you're just longtime co-host.
That's
yeah.
no veggies.
The
you
spark,
get demoted.
The spark is gone, TC. It's we're just going through the motions now.
Sorry about that. My esteemed co-host, Jake Taylor.
There you go.
John, for folks who aren't familiar with your work, give us a brief background. Left the Motley Fool.
Yeah.
What are you up to now?
So I left the Motley Fool about a year ago, almost exactly. I was there for 9 years. I was a senior analyst and the head of investor training and development. And since then, I have been working on my podcast, The J-Row Show, where I try to interview portfolio managers from some of the biggest, most respected investment management firms in the country, really about their philosophy, but really their process as well. So I'm not, you know, I've published 8 episodes now, and I haven't asked for one stock idea. I love stock ideas. It's just, that's not what I'm going for on the podcast. It's just really about like, what is the research process? What is the day-to-day life of an analyst or portfolio manager at the firm? What is expected of the analyst down to, you know, how many ideas are they expected to pitch a year? What is the deliverable expected to look like? Is it 3 pages? Is it 30 pages? Is there a model attached? Is there a PowerPoint attached? Just kind of deep into the weeds of what their day-to-day process looks like.
Teach a man to fish. And
that, yeah.
And the other one too is, oh gosh, who was it now? Was it Picasso? He had a club, like artists would get together, and it was called the Turpentine Club, I think. And it was because they didn't want to get together and talk about like art history or whatever. They want to know like, where could you buy cheap turpentine?
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Last thing I'll say about the show is I hope to start releasing some different content on the podcast. So I have just recently recorded an interview with the CEO of a company that I own stock in. And so I'll start to roll out some of these CEO interviews.
Having conducted all these conversations with these guys, what do you have any ideas about a good way to run a firm, or what sort of works, what's successful, or what's something to avoid?
Commonalities.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because so I've done maybe 2 really respected value investing firms in Harris Oakmark, and I'm going to release Diamond Hill next week.
Ooh,
and then
nice
I've done 2 sort of really respected GARPI, you know, growth at a reasonable price firm in Poland Capital and Parnassus. And there's so many similarities. You know, most analysts are expected to cover about 15 stocks, you know, on average. Most analysts are expected, and you know, on average across these 4 big firms, most analysts are expected to pitch about 3 to 4 new ideas every year. All of those firms that I just mentioned, the analysts are expected to do 3 statement financial modeling. So, you know, a lot of times when people hear modeling, they just think about like a simple DCF. That's not what these firms are talking about. So if you're interviewing at these firms, they want to know that you can, you know, build out all 3 financial statements, like a Wall Street, you know, equity research report, connect the financial statements. And they all model out, you know, Parnassus models out earnings per share 3 years. The others go out 5 to 7 years. So that's kind of common expectations. Cover 15 stocks, find me 3 or 4 new actionable undervalued ideas a year. And, you know, model out, keep an up-to-date model, update it quarterly, model out anywhere from 3 to 5 years, what you think per share, you know, economic value is going to be, and then put what you believe is an appropriate multiple. Those are some commonalities. I'll tell you one that I think is common across them, and then you can ask me any questions you want. a lot of these investors have learned to sell quickly and almost ruthlessly when something comes out of nowhere and surprises them. It's not that they don't have the emotional discipline to hold on. It's that if something comes out of nowhere, surprises them, that was not in their original analysis, was not part of their original thesis, rather than put investor capital at risk, rather than risk a blow up in that name. And some of these funds are concentrated, and if you give a blow up in one name, that can really mess with the earnings compounding of the entire portfolio. And so what they do is they will sell. This doesn't happen often where you get surprised out of nowhere, but when it does, they will sell out and then rethink it and then rehash it before deciding to get back in or not. So that's a commonality I have found.
It's a Julian Robertson tiger approach.
It is Julian Robertson. Bill Miller adopted that approach. So I interviewed Bill Miller in print, 2014 or 2015, and I asked him some of the lessons he learned from his tough time during the global financial crisis. And he said one of the biggest lessons and corrections they made was that selling out quickly when just something unexpected happens. Yeah. And so, I think some other good investors have sort of adopted that practice as well.
Just before we came on, we were talking about Einhorn's latest letter.
Yeah, so it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And so David Einhorn is an investor that I have deep admiration for. In fact, if you were to ask me, who I want to have most on my podcast, the J. Rowe Show, it would be David Einhorn. And he's done a few interviews where he's talked about this, and then he wrote about it in his year-end 2023 letter, where he said that he can no longer. His theory, his philosophy is he can no longer wait for the market to properly value stocks. So traditional value investing was you buy what you believe to be an undervalued security and you wait for the market. If you're right, sometimes you'll be wrong, but if you're right, you wait for the market to come around to your correct point of view and the market will re-rate the shares higher. And then you can benefit in two ways. You benefit from the closing of the gap. From the stock price to the estimate of intrinsic value, which is higher than the stock price. And then you can also benefit from growth of per share value over time. Einhorn believes that the active fund management industry has been decimated. That's the word that he used in his 2023 letter. And I can read a quote if you'd like.
One out of 10 have been gone out into the field and killed themselves, so
Right. And
that's to frighten
so.
the enemy.
Yeah, and that certain companies have been forgotten or left for dead. They're just not covered anymore. And so he doesn't think he can rely on the market to properly value these securities anymore, at least not in a reasonable time period. So he doesn't think he can rely on the market to re-rate a company to a higher deserving justified multiple. And so he's sort of shifted his strategy, at least in his larger positions, of investing in companies that are not only cheap. But that are currently returning, gobs of cash to shareholders through either dividends, buybacks, or in some cases, interest on like a high yielding debt security. So he's getting current cash flow from the securities. It's something, I've been thinking a lot about. And then I read the most recent issue of Value Investor Insight with Murray Stahl, the founder of Horizon Kinetics, and he said something very similarly. Here's just one sentence, but he said, quote, "Obviously some stocks deserve to be inexpensively priced, but cheapness can also just be a reflection that fewer people care and no one is paying attention," end quote. And so I thought it was something very similar to what David Einhorn was saying, that some of these stocks, even good businesses that don't deserve to be cheap, have just been completely forgotten and left for dead because there is so much, nearsightedness or even manic, laser focus on some of these tech names right now. That large swaths of the market, good growing, profitable growing business, are just forgotten about.
Do you agree that that is the traditional definition of value, that it was price action that was the thing that delivered the returns?
Jake, I think he's probably asking you.
Well, I think I know what JT's answer is going to be, but JT would say no, and I would agree with that. But go ahead,
Please,
Jay.
please, we can have a larger conversation around this.
I think it depends on which lots of different flavors of value over the years. Like,
There have been, yeah.
in a if you're buying net nets, it was probably more of a valuation re-rating. But when you took existential risk off the table for a few of these companies, like it's a pretty big binary change there when it went from this company's going to zero to wait, this might actually last a little bit longer. There's a big step up there. Kind of nonlinear. In the other, version of like, oh, never really a question about whether it's a going concern or not, but just more like it's cyclical or, maybe its best days are a little bit behind it, but it's not, there's still a viable business here. That one might have been a little bit less on just pure re-rating. But I would imagine that the neglect is likely more of a benign thing now just from so much indexation. I mean,
That's it. That, yeah.
there's just
I
not
think
enough people looking and
John Huber would, it's not John Huber's idea, but John Huber talks about it a lot. Just the differential between even big, well-followed companies will vary widely over the course of a year from a low. And the difference between the low and the high might be 3 times or 30%,
yeah,
depending on which way you're going.
Greenblatt would start his class with, he'd pull up the paper and show like the 52-week high and the 52-week low for
50% difference.
huge differences
Yeah.
on these like giant blue chip, very stable as far as you looked at any of the business results are relatively stable compared to these 50% swings in the price.
I think your return is kind of embedded when you buy. Like you've whatever the stock price does, you're getting this expected return, and provided that the stock does what you anticipated that it would do, you're getting that return whether the market recognizes it or not. But having said that, I think that Buffett's strategy is exactly that, to buy something where the expectation is that he's going to get a lot of his capital back pretty quickly. I think he's done that in just about every single big acquisition that he's done, from the railroads to take your pick. He's looking for, to Oxy recently. He's pinning them to the mast by putting that plan to return capital in his own meeting notes, saying that, hey, you said this, we're going to hold to this publicly. So I
Absolutely.
agree that even though I think Einhorn's being a little bit cute with the reasoning, but I think that the outcome is right. Yeah, I agree with the outcome.
So the way you asked the question, Tobias, was, do you think value investor returns have largely come from that? No, I
I said,
believe
yeah.
return.
Traditional was that, is that the traditional expectation?
Right. So I think the philosophy and where the returns actually came for may be different. I think the philosophy was buying at a large margin of safety, buying a dollar for 50 cents. Right, with the expectation that it's eventually going to be valued at a dollar. Right. Well, was that an expectation of traditional value investors that the margin of safety would close? And so you buy at when it's trading at 50 cents on the dollar, and then if you're right, you start to sell, when it's trading at 90 cents on the dollar, and then you're out by the time it's a dollar on
Give
the dollar.
the example of the of Nygren's 6 times earnings.
Right. And so in the real world, I do
Do you
think,
just explain, because I think we talked about that offline. Talk about the
yeah. So
do that calculation for everybody.
absolutely. So in my most recent print interview with Bill Nygren, he says, consider a stock at 6 times earnings where business value is flat. If the cash conversion rate is 100%, the company could reduce shares outstanding by 17% annually and grow per share value by 20%. So just to recap, he's saying 6 times PE, business value is flat, earnings are not growing, they're just stable. Free cash flow conversion to net income is 1 times or 100%. In that scenario, the company could reduce shares outstanding by 17% annually and grow per share value by 20%. So earnings per share are growing by 20%, even though net income is growing 0%. And actually,
So,
Mobison put out a white paper like a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, talking about this very thing, how low PEs can drive massive EPS growth when you're buying at a discount.
let's keep this thought experiment going. Let's say I own stock in a company that's doing that and it buys back stock, and eventually it buys back all of the outstanding stock, and I'm the only person left.
Right,
Do I
right.
care where the bid is in the market, or am I getting the intrinsic flows that are far superior to anything that I've ever paid?
So this wasn't planned, but so in the same interview,
Nothing is on this show.
right? No, I love this. In the same interview, Bill Nygren says, if a company generates a lot of excess cash and buys back stock when the valuation is too low, that eventually forces the valuation higher. So there's a forcing mechanism. So Tobias and Jake, so think about
But I'm not
this.
even, I don't even need it. I don't even need a quote. I'm saying I like this thing
I
unquoted.
love this thing. I love so if this let's use easy math. I can go through the math of the 17% to the 20% if y'all want, because I broke it out for a student that I mentor, but let's just do
Let's
easy
do it.
math.
Let's do it. Let's break it out.
So it'll just take me a second. I have it right here. So let's assume EBIT, let's assume zero debt. Just so interest expense is zero. EBIT is 125. $125, tax rate is 20%. Assume 100 shares outstanding. Tax rate is 20%, so 20% of 125 is $25 in taxes, so net income is 100. We also know, based on the Nygren quote, that free cash flow is at least 100 because free cash flow conversion is 100%. So he gave us a PE of 6, right? So PE of 6, we know that net income is 100. So 6 times 100, we know the market value is 600. So we have a market cap of 600, 100 shares outstanding. So stock price is 6. Now, you repurchase 17% of 100 shares outstanding, which means you buy back 17 shares for $102. 17 shares times the $6 per share stock price. Okay, that's $102. So you spent all of your free cash flow was 100. In this example, we're saying 102. Net income is still 100 because remember, he said earnings are stable or flat, and buybacks come out of distributable or free cash flow, not from net income. So net income is still 100. Shares outstanding are now 83. We started with 100 shares. We bought back 17. We now have 83 shares outstanding. So original EPS was $1, net income of 100 divided by 100 shares outstanding, $1. The new EPS after the buyback is 120, net income of still 100, now divided by 83 shares outstanding. That's $1.20. So EPS went from $1 to $1.20. You get 20% growth in earnings per share when you buy back 17% of the shares when the PE is 6. Net income did not grow one penny. So that's the power of buybacks at low PEs or high free cash flow yields.
I saw a good Twitter. This has been on Twitter for the last week, but they said, "What is the if Michael Saylor continues to buy back Bitcoin and he ends up owning all of Bitcoin? What is the intrinsic value of Bitcoin?"
Ooh, I didn't see that tweet. Did it give a answer?
Well, it's got to be, it's a thought experiment, but
Yeah.
you can work it out if Michael Saylor owns all of Bitcoin.
But Tobias, here is not a thought experiment. So let's just use easy math. 10 times earnings and you're buying back 10% of shares a year, 10% of the market cap a year. If the stock price does not go up, then you end up owning the entire company after 10 years.
Sounds
That's
great.
the forcing mech. Well, I know you love that, but that's the forcing mechanism that Bill Nygren talked about in that interview. When you're buying back stock at low PEs, but really at large discounts to intrinsic value, it forces the multiple higher. Otherwise, you're going to end up owning the entire thing while earnings per share are growing 20, 30, 40% a year because you're buying it back at lower and lower PEs.
I mean, let's do it.
This
Sounds
is how I
great
win. Yeah, this is how I win. Exactly right.
to
And so,
I gave a little, it was kind of a private presentation, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now. And I went through a lot of this math and used AutoZone as an example of kind of what what this looked like in an archetypal sense.
Absolutely.
Very minimal top line growth, margin stayed reasonably, you know, call it 11, 12%. Lots of buybacks done at very, and they had the opportunity to do it. Like they never got much above a 10 PE for that entire time. And
It's
so
a beautiful thing. It's a
it's
beautiful
a very
thing.
beautiful thing. So then I broke it down to really, you could turn the world into two types of investors. The ones who, on the day that they buy, they hope to see the price go down. And then there's the ones who buy and they hope to see the price go up. Which one are you? And this is like in one world, like I would say the last 10 years, or maybe call it the t 2008 to 2021 maybe time period, the you did better if you were the type who bought something and just wanted to see the price go up that next day. My hypothesis is that the next 10 years, this the 20s, and the title of the talk was the boring 20s instead of roaring, in that it wasn't going to be top line, it wasn't going to be, you know, prices ripping and multiples going up. It was going to be boring stuff like capital allocation, reasonable business results that then were translated into a cheap multiple turning into an attractive earnings yield on the purchase, and that was how you were going to win the next 10 years.
Jake, I not only love that, but I agree 100%. In Sea Change, which Howard Marks wrote, I don't know, a year and a half ago, he said basically the same thing. What worked during the era of free money is not what is going to work going forward.
Murray
But
Stahl had some other interesting, you had some other interesting insights into Murray Stahl too.
I just think that Murray is he's an incredible thinker. So I saw him speak live last year at the Project Punch Card conference in New York.
Haven't heard of
And
that one.
that's
What's that about?
so it it's actually the lineup is always incredible. So last year's lineup was like Lee Cooperman. By the way, Lee is the second guy that I want to get on my show the most. So he calls in over Zoom. Everyone else is speaking live. He calls in over
From the
Zoom,
car.
and he's sitting at his desk in Florida. I just read his book, by the way, not to get off track, but he's put out a book, From the Bronx to Wall Street or something. He's 79 or 80. He's still working 17-hour days today. 17-hour days. He just loves it. Anyway, and so someone in the audience asks him what he's buying, what he owns, and he takes out off his desk a piece of paper, a print piece of paper, and he reads. 15, it must have been 15 of the 20 stocks that he owns. He just read, well, I own this and I own this and I own this and I own this. I've been buying this. I've been buying this. He was just so transparent and awesome. But Murray Stahl talked that year. David Marcus runs Michael Price's family office, the late Michael Price. Just, you know, an incredible lineup. But so there, Murray Stahl's lecture was on investing in royalty companies because Murray Stahl believes that inflation is going to be higher and more volatile for longer. Not necessarily, you know, 6-7% inflation, but above the 2% target, and it's going to be more volatile. And in a high and volatile inflationary world, he loves royalty companies. Royalty companies own land with natural resources and lease out the land to, you know, E&Ps, exploration production companies, mining
That's
companies.
how TPL do it. You can just get right on the royalty. You can get a cut of the royalty too. There are some
Yeah,
different variations of
Texas
that. Yeah.
Pacific Land is a big holding of Murray Stahl, and you don't invest any CapEx or very little, and you don't have any expenses. You're just leasing out land. And so Murray's thesis on these royalty companies like Texas Pacific Land is that the top line is going to grow with inflation, but your expenses don't grow with inflation. So you've got one of these, expenses are flat, top line's growing, and so the margins expand. And so in virtually any environment, these things are generating 40, 50% free cash flow margins across the cycle. If you look at Texas Pacific Land's margins, some of the highest margins you've ever seen, you
What
know,
is this,
higher than.
software?
Yeah, exactly. But higher. And so that's what he spoke about then was how to con you know how to invest through inflation. But the thing that fascinates me about Murray Stahl is on the one hand, He's a traditional value investor in the sense that he wants to buy something at a significant discount to his estimate, conservative estimate of intrinsic value. And he's not scared to look at old economy companies. And in the most recent issue of Value Investor Insight, he was saying that some of these high valued tech names are going to come under pressure for a variety of reasons, one of them being more competition from China, but a variety of reasons. On the other hand, he was one of the earliest investors at scale, at size in Bitcoin. And he's been mining Bitcoin for years now, for
Out of his
years.
basement. No, I'm just kidding.
I think it may have may have started there, but now he's got a full operation going. And in this latest issue of Value Investor Insight, he talks about how he plans to hopefully bring his Bitcoin mining company public.
I'm gonna sell the tools and show, I'm gonna sell the energy to the Bitcoin miners.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, you have this interesting dichotomy where he's, more traditional value focused. And a lot of traditional value investors that I follow are not yet on board with Bitcoin. And I don't know if they ever will be, but they're not yet, at least. Murray is, and he was early, and he was in size and large. And he's a billionaire. I think he was a billionaire before a lot of the Bitcoin stuff, but he's definitely a billionaire now.
What do you think the reticence is for many value investors with Bitcoin?
Well, by definition, if you're an intrinsic value investor, it means you're trying to value the future cash flows of the business. The value of any cash flowing security, any financial security, any financial asset is the present value of future free cash flow. You can't do that with Bitcoin. There,
It's a
so
currency, right? It's like
yeah,
it's much
it,
more suited to the macro guys who like, they use cup and saucer or bearish Arami to kind of work out which way Bitcoin's going. But then,
but
I guess the intrinsic argument might be you
different
just
methods.
short the US dollar printing or you short central bank currencies.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I think their reticence is that there's no cash flows to value. It's not throwing off any cash flows, and because of that, they don't believe it can be intrinsically valued. Yeah.
Well, let me ask this: what's the right price for Bitcoin?
I wish I knew.
Well, that's why I like that little frame that I saw it on Twitter. I apologize to whoever I've stolen this from, but the frame was, if Michael Saylor buys all of Bitcoin, what is the intrinsic value of, or what's the value of Bitcoin? What's Bitcoin worth? If Michael Saylor owns a whole lot, it's not worth anything.
That's interesting. It'll be MicroStrategy that owns it because I don't
I
know.
think he's selling
I think he's
MicroStrategy to
selling
buy Bitcoin
5,000
directly.
shares a day or something like that of MicroStrategy stock, and so it'll be MicroStrategy that ends up owning it. But yeah, no, that's interesting.
Let me do a quick shout out and then we'll do some veggies. VA, is that what's VA? Help me out.
Virginia.
Virginia, Dubai, Kennesaw, Georgia, Valparaiso, Gothenburg, Sweden. LA in the house, Tallahassee, Antigonish, Savonlinna, Finland. What's up? Tampa, Miami, Old Ocean, Texas, Hamburg, Germany, Jupiter, Florida. Congrats. Porto de Mos, Portugal, Mendocino, California, Quebec City, Canada, Boston. What's up? Some good ones in here. Nashville, Tennessee. Congrats. That's a good list.
It's a
What do you
great
got us
list.
for? What do you got for us? On the veggies, JT. London, UK.
Oh, there we
Last
go.
one.
All
Sorry,
right.
buddy.
So this is called Ants and Lions Hunting and Private Equity. So we'll see if we can turn this all into making any sense out of it. But so first, a shout out to my man George for sending me this delicious little veggies prompt from it's from a Scientific American little piece that's titled "These invasive ants are changing how lions hunt." So we'll start out with the idea that, regularly, almost every year at the AGMs, Mr. Buffett will say that in economics, you always have to ask yourself, and then what? And the same is true for another complex adaptive system, which is Mother Nature. And we're going to follow a series of and then what's, and we'll see where it goes. And then we'll see if we can draw some lessons back to business and investing. So researchers were exploring a regional ecosystem in Kenya, Africa, and there were these ants that were indigenous to that region, and they were fierce defenders of these local acacia trees. So when an elephant would come to graze on the tree, for instance, or trample it over, the ants would swarm the elephant and crawl up inside of its 9-foot nose and use their mandibles to pinch, inside the elephant. As you
Nightmare.
can, yeah, it's rather unpleasant, I imagine. And as a result of these ants, the elephants would largely leave these trees alone. It's not worth it, right? So, and then the it's really not worth going and getting like an ant neti pot every time you try to eat a leaf off of a tree. So these indigenous ants had long protected and their own living home in this symbiotic relationship. Well, recently, researchers found a new invasive species of ant has moved in, and they're killing off the local indigenous acacia ants. And these invasive ants are actually smaller than the acacia ants, but they'll team up and they'll hold the acacia ants down by their limbs and then basically like draw and quarter them. They'll di dismember the ant, which is, Mother Nature is not messing around. So in not too long after this the new ants are displacing the old ants. And shortly thereafter, herbivores have figured out that these acacia trees aren't being protected by their little, these tiny protectors, and especially the elephants, who do a lot of damage rather quickly. So the tree population, of course, has started to decline. And with that less tree cover, then we're going, again, these series of and then what's, with less tree cover, the zebras are more safe because less trees make it harder for a lion to ambush an unsuspecting zebra and make them their lunch. So, and then what? What are the lions doing now that they can't eat zebras as readily? Well, it turns out they've shifted to hunting buffalo more. Only that's a lot tougher and more dangerous for the lions because the buffalo is twice as massive as the zebra, and they have a much better defense against lions. Like, there's videos online of these buffaloes like chucking a 400-pound lion into the air to fend off attacks. And of course, the lions are they're at least moderately successful, so the buffalo population is suffering now. And so this is like kind of a classic butterfly effect, right? You disturb one little small, seemingly inconsequential thing, in this case, a tiny invasive species of ant, and you get this cascading effects where they lead to an eventual decrease in a buffalo population, 10 links down the chain. So the first lesson, I think, is that it's fiendishly difficult to predict all of these complex interactions, right? And so it is with economics. No matter how much modeling expertise you have, how much modeling you do, it's impossible to predict, I think, how shifting, like in this, let's say, interest rates, for instance, how they ooze their way into every crevice of the economy and what will manifest because of these changes. So now we're going to shift to talking about private equity and see if we can draw some parallels to our, and then what exercise. So Bain and Company came out with a recent report on all things private equity, and this was flagged by a friend of the show, Dan Rasmussen. So in 2023, the deal value fell by 37% from the year before, and exit values slid by 44%, so almost half as much. And things are not very much like they were in the go-go years of like 2021. And today, nearly half of all global buyout companies have been held for at least 4 years. So there's $3.2 trillion of aging, unexited company value on PE's balance sheet right now. And just for context, that was like $1 trillion in 2016. So, and of course, there's a lot of discretion around how you mark these assets. Like, good firms are still, they're clear about their valuation policies to their LPs and are appropriately conservative. But of course, I think that Cliff Asness would agree that volatility laundering is still alive and well in the PE industry. Like, if you think about it just from an incentive standpoint, like, why, if you were a PE firm, would you want to show bad results? And also, if you're one of these big pools of capital, like an endowment, why would you want to hear bad results if it's possible that they might smooth themselves away over time, right? Like, of course, like, just don't tell me. And if it's going to end up being better later. So I'm kind of left wondering, to whom will private equity exit these $3.2 trillion worth of businesses to? Themselves, each other, public markets? I mean, those are the IPO windows have been a bit frosty lately. And then the FT Alphaville, I guess, I mean, if you guys follow and read that, but they said that the PE is sitting on an astonishing 2.6 trillion of capital it'll eventually have to deploy. So, public companies tend to borrow in long term and fixed, and private equity tends to borrow short and floating rate. So often borrowing, and they're often borrowing in private credit markets rather than issuing bonds like a public company would. And so the median sponsor-backed company saw their borrowing rates already move from 4.9% in 2022 to 7.2% in 2023, whereas the median S&P 500 borrower only moved from 3.2 to 3.7. So the S&P's hardly even noticed that rates have gone up relative to private equity, which has really seen them gone up, really seen them increase. So for PE, like basically what was once cheap debt isn't cheap anymore. And then what about like valuations? This is kind of another, issue that have been talked about. Private equity closed transactions at 13.8 EV to EBITDA in 2021 and 2022. That number used to be more like 5 times rather than
Ouch.
13 times when David Swensen was putting up awesome returns at Yale by tipping towards privates. It's so for from reference, from 1990 to 2010, private equity returned 14.4% per year compared to 8.1 for the S&P 500. And that 6% roughly outperformance was net of private equity's 2 and 20 fee structure. So that means the gross return was really more like 20% a year for that kind of heyday. But there's a feeling that a lot of this compounding is kind of stalling. And last year, revenues for PE firms were actually slower growing than the S&P 500, 4% versus 5%. So, and PE-backed firms generally have lower margins than public companies. So the rise in interest costs have meant that the median PE-backed firm now is actually generating zero free cash flow. All the margin has basically shrunk and been absorbed by debt servicing. So after 40 years of declining rates, in our analogy, like maybe these were sort of the ants that were protecting the acacia trees. Perhaps the Fed elephant has removed the tree cover, and these lions are going to have a much more difficult time finding juicy zebras to feast upon. And with this more expensive debt, perhaps a less target-rich and opportunity set, higher valuations, too much money chasing too few assets. I personally find it a little hard to be as bullish on the prospects for most of private equity. And of course, I'm sure there are exceptions of people doing smart things. There always are. So perhaps they might be forced to hunt more dangerous beasts like buffalo and are more likely then to suffer resulting injuries. And in general, whether it's Mother Nature or finance, you got to be careful of these small, seemingly inconsequential changes because they can lead to rather consequential consequences that just propagate throughout a system.
Good one, JT.
That was excellent. Some
The
good connections there.
private equity model is one way of converting that flat, no growth, fixed PE stock that's doing all the buybacks. It's a way of like turning that into equity appreciation because you're using the cash flows to pay down the debt, and your equity, assuming that the enterprise value is staying steady, your equity should be going up as the debt comes down.
Yeah, how do you become a billionaire in private equity? Borrow $1 billion and pay it back.
Yeah, that's true. That was awesome. If my question is, if everything is a complex adaptive system, which I think it is, markets and economies especially, and we can't predict the future because of that, what do we do as investors, right? Like, that's a conundrum, which makes investing hard. In the last couple of years, investing doesn't seem that hard, right? If you own a tech index, you're doing great.
I mean, if you own SPY, you're doing pretty well.
Exactly. If you're doing SPY, you're doing very well, yeah. But it turns out it is hard because everything is hard to predict. Yet, as investors, we're trying to make predictions. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to see which stocks are going to be higher in the future. And it's a prediction.
My mind goes to an insurance analogy, and because that is also about predicting the future, it's about, what risks are you taking?
Absolutely.
Are you being properly compensated to take that risk? And I think there's a couple different smart ways to do it. I think that you could think of it like auto insurance, like let's say Geico as a for instance. And I would liken actually what Toby does to Geico, which is you don't know exactly which of the policies that you write is going to be profitable or not, but you know that as a base, large law of large numbers expected outcome that you have a little bit of an edge there just based on what you're choosing. You're probably, arbitraging some behavioral bias. And you know, it's gonna end up working out okay, and you'll probably do a little bit better than average because of that. And then you could, I think, occasionally markets throw off just absolute no-brainer things that just don't make any sense to the even a reasonably intelligent business person who's looking at the situation. And you get paid really well to do that. And recognizing those, you kind of have to hang around and see them enough to find them. But they're very, very rare. And I would liken that then to like specialty insurance, like a G. Jane is writing, where there's these mispriced things where, like, okay, we're getting a ton of premium relative to what we feel like the risk is that we're underwriting. And you just have to be very discerning at that point, and recognize that it's reasonably rare that those get thrown up, but they do on occasion present themselves. And so I think both of those make sense to me as ways to mitigate the uncertainty of the future.
I mean, that's how I deal with it, especially the way that Tobias does. There's overwhelming research, and I shared, I think, a dozen slides on X at one point in time. I can send this to y'all, showing that high free cash flow yield is far and away, or owner earnings yield, whatever you want to call it, is far and away the best predictor of forward rate of return. Far and away. Bank of America looked at 40 metrics. This was about 7 or 8 years ago, but it looked at 40 metrics and enterprise value to free cash, or free cash flow to enterprise value, outperformed the market by the most. Manning and Napier, T. Rowe Price, several other firms. There's, like I said, there's like a dozen slides that I sent, all showing that free cash flow yield, high free cash flow yield, is far and away the best predictor of market outperformance over a 5-year period, far and away. So it's empirical.
I think it varies a little bit depending on the date that you do it,
Sure.
but free cash flow is it's free cash flow, or it's operating income, or it's operating cash flow, or it's one of those more broader based earnings measures than just the E right at the very bottom of the statement. But I think the interesting thing is how predictive it is. So that's one thing that I've spent a lot of time looking at. How far out can you? So I always thought, quality. And there's lots of different definitions of quality, but we know return on equity is pretty mean reverting, but there are other measures of quality, some of which are less mean reverting. But of all of them, I can't find anything that really has any predictiveness that is anywhere near just the price ratio. So price to free or free cash flow to EV, say, that is predictive out to about 5 years. Beyond 5 years, nothing's predictive. And it's only the price ratios out to about 5 years. The quality metrics, funnily enough, seem to break down pretty quickly, or I can't find the
No, that's what the research shows. So the 40 metrics that Bank of America looked at weren't just valuation. It was quality ratios, profitability ratios, growth ratios, and free cash flow yield. Far and away was the best predictor of 5-year performance.
given that that is the case, what do you think is the utility of building those complex models that go out 5 to 7 years?
Marketing. Sorry. What?
I'll say for cyclical industries, I think there's probably some utility in getting a normalized mid-cycle number. I think it doesn't have to be, 5 years is, arbitrary, but I think one of the mistakes some investors make when they're earlier in their career, or retail investors with less experience that just go to Yahoo Finance or some other free site and get a PE, is they have no idea what's in that E, right? Like, they don't know if that's peak earnings, trough earnings, if there's a
Asset
bunch of,
sale.
exactly. And so I think modeling out a few years can at least help you get to a more mid-cycle number, but also normalized number that takes out some of these non-recurring,
One of the challenges of doing so, let's say 3 years, we agree that you have some predictability out to 3 years. One of the problems with a 3-year modeling number is if it's a high growth company, the growth doesn't really describe the value of the company until it has a few more years to compound. So you're always missing those. I don't think that's such a It's a little bit of a bias of my method that it's going to miss those higher growth companies, but I think that the base rates for those higher growth companies has historically been so bad that it doesn't bother me that they're sort of not being caught in the method. But I'm just like curious, what do you think? Does that modeling capture, does a 5 or 7 year, smoothing cyclicals make sense, but it also lets you capture some of those higher growth companies.
In my opinion, if you miss some of the higher growth companies, if you're good at doing what you do, you can generate the exact same returns or better than a high growth investor because you're going to have fewer blowups. You're going to have fewer blowups. A high growth investor was going to have more multi-baggers potentially, but more blowups. And so in the end, I've looked into this. I've back tested a lot of performance. I've looked into a lot. I think the best investors outside of Buffett and Marks and maybe a handful of others, on one hand, I think the best investors are doing 15% annualized over time, over a career.
I think that's about
15%,
right, sir. I think
not
that's the
20.
right bogey.
Yeah. The best of the best are doing 15. And some of those are the best of the best growth investors. And some of those are the best of the best more value investors. There's a spectrum, of course, of value investing and a spectrum of growth investing. But the rides will be very different. But if you look 10 to 15 years in the future, I think you end up in the exact same place.
I think somebody who can do a sustainable 15 is elite. I think that that's absolutely elite.
I think that's elite. That's exactly right.
I know a grizzly old manager who says, like, anyone who's aiming for more than that is basically almost assuredly going to blow themselves up.
Yeah.
People don't want to hear that right now because everything's going up every day by a lot, right? And so people don't want to hear that right now. But Tobias, back to what you said about the free cash flow, it's such an important concept. And back to the idea of you can buy in the whole company, if the stock price doesn't go up. A lot of people don't actually think about what free cash flow is. But Warren Buffett's got this great quote, book value or invested capital is what's been put into the business. Intrinsic value is what you can take out of the business. That's free cash flow. It is what is left to investors after investing in maintaining and growing the business. It's
So that's what
after,
I was going to
yeah.
push back a little bit on the and do a kind of, red team or
Please.
devil's advocate. How do you avoid then, not to name names, but like let's say like a Boeing situation where they borrowed and did a ton of buybacks in a, I don't know, let's say before 2020, and now operationally have really not been particularly stellar, it seems. Did they underinvest in their business? How do you
Yeah,
know
I
where's the
think
right amount of,
Intel did the same exact thing under their prior CEO, where Intel for a while was the leader in semiconductor manufacturing, but then they just they made the decision to invest less in the business, less in R&D. They mortgaged their future, they mortgaged their moat in order to buy back a lot of stock and do this sort of financial engineering. There's a time and place when buybacks are absolutely the best use of capital. Buffett has a quote. He says, when your stock is undervalued, it's the surest way. The surest way to grow per share value is to buybacks at a discount. But not if you're sacrificing your moat, right? Not if you're underinvesting in R&D. And so Intel went through that. Now they have a new leader.
How do
Boeing's
you
going through
identify
this
that in
now.
real time?
Who did?
H
How do you
how do you that in real
tell
time?
financial engineering from
Rather than like after the fact where Intel stumbles, Boeing stumbles. Whoops, we should have paid attention when they were doing that 5 years ago. How do you know 5 years ago that they
hard.
would?
I mean, it's hard. You can probably look at market share, loss. Intel was definitely, there was a point where it started to lose market share, and those market share losses started to accelerate, and they just came up with a bunch of excuses. It's not easy though. Another thing is, ASML, arguably the most important company in the world. Intel had ego, whatever you want to call it, saying we're gonna make the most advanced chips in the world without ASML's machines, without their EUV machines. And they said, we're going to try to replicate this. Well, Canon and Nikon tried it over a 20-year period and they gave up. They said, uncle, they completely got out of the EUV business completely. It's very hard to do. And if you do it, you need hundreds of billions over 20 years. And Intel tried it and then they fell farther behind. So, but that's all hindsight. Like you said, I wasn't really doing a deep dive into Intel at the time. But so, maybe market share losses, something like that.
It's
But yeah,
hard to
this.
know. I think probably that you need to take a, even one more step back from that. And somebody said it in the comments here, but don't buy fast-changing industries. Like that's all of these businesses essentially. Like Microsoft is a business that they've pivoted a few times over the years to get to where they are now. And but that's uncommon. That's unusual for businesses to be able to pivot. Most businesses,
Especially that large, especially when
they
they're
just
that large.
Kodak. You know, they're just like Kodak had the first digital camera,
Yeah.
and
Buffett,
whoops.
2, 3 years, 2, 3 weeks ago, I posted, I think 8 quotes from Buffett saying virtually that, he said, Berkshire Hathaway is just as fascinated by all of these innovations as you are, as the rest of the world is. We're just as fascinated by it. We just don't know how to model it. We don't know how to predict it. And, when there's lots of disruptive innovation happening, the ground under those businesses are not stable. And so it's an industry that's very hard to build moats, sustainable moats, and it's an industry that's very hard to build high barriers to entry.
At one point, Bill Gates, I think in the late 90s, said that he, because of those exact factors, that tech should probably really trade with a low multiple, lower than most businesses, because it's that terminal value is kind of harder to underwrite with so much disruption.
Well, those ideas come into vogue every mid cycle. So we've just gone through one where tech gets a high multiple, but we might go through one where tech gets a low multiple.
Obsolescence is a big risk. It's a big risk. But just back to that free cash flow, that's what it is. It's what the owner could take out. It's what a sole proprietor could take out of the business every year and pay himself a dividend. It's after investing and protecting that moat, after investing in all of the growth down the income statement and the growth down the cash flow statement and working capital and CapEx and acquisitions. After all of that, it's what a proprietor could take out and pay himself or herself a dividend. And so that's why it's so predictive of, if a dividend yield is what the company actually pays out as a dividend every year, free cash flow yield is what the company could potentially pay out if it chose to return all of its free cash flow as a dividend. And earlier in the show, we went through the math talking about how even if the company is not growing, 0% growth, as long as it's not deteriorating, as long as it's not shrinking, company can grow 20% a year if it's buying back, stock at a single digit multiple. And that can go on for a long period of time. That's sustainable growth.
It's a shower, not a grower.
It's a shower, not a grower.
What's Buffett's little, is it, was it one of his lieutenants, Ted or Todd, has that Sunday lunch with him where they discuss, but
That
do you remember the formula?
Todd goes to his house. Yeah, the formula is they look at the S&P 500, and they have three criteria. What stocks are trading at a forward PE, 12-month forward PE of 15 or less?
Yeah.
Which do you have a 90% confidence level earnings will be higher 5 years from now? Doesn't matter how much higher, just higher. And then which do you have at least a 50% confidence level earnings per share can compound by at least 7% over the next 5 years.
What does 7% compound over 5 years get you to? Is it 50% bigger or something like that?
Yeah, it's 50% bigger. What I think it does is if you're buying 15 times or less today, if you're paying 15 times or less today, and a company can grow high single digits, 7, 8, 9, you can grow into a 10 times free cash flow in 5 years. That's
Yeah,
the
right.
kicker. Jake, you said it earlier today, grow into a 10% earnings yield. That's sort of like my rough heuristic. I'd love to pay 10 times or less today for a growing business. If I can't, I'd really like to see it grow into a 10% free cash flow yield by year five. That's sort of my rough heuristic that I try to stick to. And I'll just go one step further. I know we're running out of time. If it is one of these faster growers that I get seduced by and I pay 20 or 25 times earnings, I'd like to believe that the earnings per share can grow fast enough so that it drops to a market multiple by year five. So down to 15 or 16 times by year five. Those are rough heuristics for me. Look at a company like Builders FirstSource with, this is a company that is, it's put out 3 year guidance for 3 year forward EPS guidance of $18 of earnings per share. It's at 200 today. So, Builder is trading at 11 times. That's the bot 18 is the bottom end of its guidance. It's trading at 11 times the bottom end of its guidance 3 years out. And this company serves absolutely a crucial economic need. It saves its customers time, money, and waste. And in the last 2.5 years, it has bought back 37% of the stock. Hold on, I wrote this down. So in the last 2.5 years, it's bought back 37% of the stock at an average stock price of 83. It's trading at 200 today. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Are they still doing buybacks at 200, or do they
Oh, sorry.
turn
Yes.
it down?
So no. So over the next 3 years, they gave medium-term guidance, 3-year guidance. So over the next 3 years, they plan to buy back another 30 to 40% of the shares at 11 times earnings. 3 year forward, 11 times earnings, looking at 3 year out numbers.
Do you ever worry that a company like Builders FirstSource is beholden to the building? Like, we've got this little, I don't know, I just don't know whether this is secular or cyclical, but we underbuilt for a long period of time following the GFC
Over 10 years, I'd say.
over 10 years. Yeah. And you can see that in the data that we haven't built enough houses through that period of time. And so now there's this unusual thing in the market where rates have gone up so quickly, people who are hot, have a mortgage pre-2020 or whatever can't get out of there. Well, it's probably later than that, pre-2022, pre-2023. Are kind of stuck and they can't move. So these new houses that have traditionally been at a huge premium to previously owned houses, they now trade at about the same price. So the builders are just shipping houses and are sort of going through this unusual boom. I don't know whether it's going to peter out this year or whether it's got, a decade to run. I have no idea. But to what extent do you sort of think about that when you think about something like Builders FirstSource?
So 2/3 of Builders FirstSource revenue comes from new home construction. It's an important part of their business. It's the most important part of their business by far. Two things I'd say is the latest what's that podcast? The deep dive built business deep dive podcast. I'm not gonna be able to think of the name right now, but they did a deep dive on D.H. Horton. And the guest who knows the industry very well estimates it's going to take, could take 20 years to dig ourselves out of this hole. That's how underbuilt we've been. I've done similar math suggesting it could take us 7 to 10 years to build us out of this hole, depending on how many new starts we have a year. So I do think we could have an extended upcycle in new home construction because the supply-demand imbalance, I feel, is acute. It's real. We have record low supply, inventories home for sale, or thereabout record lows at the same time when demand is sky high because millennials are entering prime home buying years. And so there's an acute supply demand imbalance. And so I think that's one thing. The other thing with Builders FirstSource is they've transitioned their business model. A couple of years ago, less than 30% of their business came from these value-added services. Value-added means they're doing things the construction crew used to do. Like, so they will completely prefab offsite. Builder will prefab a roof truss or a floor truss or a whole wall panel and then deliver it and then install it. So that's saved labor, right? Time. They install windows, doors, custom millwork. They build it all offsite and install it. So things that the construction crew used to do, Builders is now doing for them. That's much higher margin, 800 to 1,000 basis points of higher margin than simply distribution of lumber, which is their older business model. There's a lot. They've been a leader in consolidating the industry, so the industry is much more rational when it comes to pricing. So I think there's a lot going for the company, and then just buying back a lot of stock, 37% in less than 3 years.
I certainly like the
I know you do.
buybacks.
I do too. It's weird that we're getting excited about buybacks and a lot of other investors are getting excited by the Nvidia conference yesterday, which was very exciting. Don't get me wrong. It's just, there's lots to think. There's more than one exciting thing in the market happening right now is all I'm trying to say.
What do you make of that? Is that, sustainable? Is that,
AI.
There's a little AI kind of, there's a little boomlet going on. There's a little bit like Cisco in the early 2000s. Or do you think it's got a sort of longer timeline than that? Actually, we're coming up on time here, John, so the quickest.
Speaking of time, right. That's for next time. Have me back. Have me back.
Yeah, absolutely, we will. Good point. That's John Rotondi. How can folks get in contact with you or follow along with what you're doing?
I'm on Twitter at J Row Grow, so JROGROW.
And what's your podcast called?
The J Row Show.
Good name.
Thanks.
Jake, as always, a pleasure.
Great veggies, Jake. I'm getting stronger. Veggies.
Thanks for
Appreciate it.
coming, folks. We'll be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel. I think we've got Eric Cinnamond coming on next week.
Oh, fun.
Jake managed to lure him
Out of
out of his cave.
absolute return bear cave.
Hibernation
Yeah.
cave, yeah.
Thanks, folks.